This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the April 1987 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Ballads in Three-Quarter Time by Robert Charles Wilson. I remember how it was that night we decided to kill Toby Torvis. It was an average night at Toby's Roadhouse out on Route 16. Probably you don't know Toby's, but you know some place like it. Slat roof and gravel parking lot and halide lights that draw the summer bugs and big old clouds. Freight trucks whooshing in from the route and settling down on their repeller shields like dogs curling up to sleep. Inside, the drummer and the fiddler and the guitar man up on a wood stage with colored spotlights slung from the rafters and a blue haze of smoke and noise, and this night, me out front dishing up Rose of Cimarron or Tennessee Waltz in a gingham dress like the preacher's wives wear on TV, only sexier about the neckline. I am, of course, a phony girl, a lonely Nell. My given name is Idella. There is no last. To Toby's place belonged to Torvis, Toby Torvis, a beer barrel of a man who hated his customers and hated us who worked for him even more. From the stage, I could see him shadowing Jack the barman, making sure the drinks weren't too generous. Sometimes Torvis shaved the service so tight it drove customers away, saving nickels and dimes at the expense of dollars. But Torvis didn't care, for a man like that, being miserable is its own reward. And I could see Leif, too, as the stage lights dimmed and the band unplugged for a break. Leif is the other phony here, a barroom cowboy. He has his own table next to the jukebox. Sometimes I'd see him shooting pool all by himself because the clientele wouldn't play with him. More often, he'd be doing his Bowden duty, sweet-talking some half-drunken, goggle-eyed country girl till she was pink in the face and damn near swooning. It's in the nature of the work we do. Leif is handsome as a Hollistar, and I am, I guess, pretty enough, and we liked each other a lot. I admired his big jaw and his twinkly blue eyes, his razor-creased towers and his starched white shirt. Right at that moment, I wanted to go sit with him, share that dingy round little table with him and sit together, proud and contented. But, of course, Torvis wouldn't allow it. We had our jobs to do. So I climbed down from the stage and went and sat on my own table, drinking cold tea from a whiskey glass and lighting up a big welcome howdy smile. I did not feel that when a feed wholesaler name of Courtney pulled up a chair by my side. "Pretty girl," he sighed. "My, but you a pretty girl." I was not so depressed that I could not appreciate a man who calls me that. This one was fat and wore big Buddy Holly glasses, but I like a man who calls me girl or woman. The prissy ones get real upright about it. It was coming on 1 a.m., and I had done a final set when Courtney got around to the inevitable suggestion. I pointed out the plain silver band round his ring finger and said, "You're a married man, ain't you?" And he blushed very prettily and began a sob story, and so with gaze I paid not much attention. Over at the other table, Leif had attracted a mousy woman with gristly cords up her neck and hair like a leaky hayrick. He flashed me one long, careless look, and I returned it. We were done before either whole human noticed a thing, but it was unprofessional, and I think Torvis might have seen. Before long, I was back in my trailer in the rear lot of the place, listening to the roar of traffic on the route while this man, Courtney, worked off the memories of his wife. He was sweet and excitable, and it didn't take too long. When we finished, we performed the ritual. He pulled his pants on and said, how he loved me, but he's got a woman and three kids, and I got a teary but tough, and I told him I understood, making it sound like I really didn't. And he went home consoled and self-congratulatory, and isn't that the purpose of it all? That's what they told us, at least, down on the farm. It was 2:30, and I desperately wanted to sleep, but old Torvis came knocking at the door and rousted me up. He stood there with his hands on his big belly and his eyebrows humped up like two caterpillars. "There's men inside," he said, "who would like to meet you." "Oh, come on, Mr. Torvis. In my contract it says, you work for me," he said, "or you don't. That's the long and short of it. So get your flabby ass back inside that pretty little dress and get inside." He's wrong about the contract, but there's nothing I could do about it. As a fake person, I don't have what you call recourse to the law. It made me spitting mad, and I thought again of my roommate from the flesh farm, Laurel Ann, and how she had one day thrown a pot full of chicken noodle soup right in the face of our dialect coach. How good Tooby Torvis would have looked drenched in chicken stock and noodles. But I did what he said. When I stepped down, there was a ruckus over at Leif's trailer. A jealous husband banging on the door and kicking at the siding. A big one, drunk enough to be mean. Torvis just watched, chewing a fat cigar. The door swung open. First, the wife stumbled out, staring at her husband with big, admiring eyes. Then he pushed her behind him, and Leif came down. The jealous husband said a lot of nasty things and then punched Leif right in the face. Leif fell down. Leif is big, but he can't do much to protect himself. They wrote that into his wet program. Wouldn't do to have an outraged fake beating up some hapless whole human. That is not in the scenario. The human man stalked away with his wife. I wanted to run over to Leif, but Torvis dragged me back into the place. That's bad business sense, too, not taking care of his investments. All for naught. The action had pretty much died down inside. A trucker bought me tea till he collapsed. Out back, I helped Leif into my trailer and sponged his bruises. Torvis told him, Leif said sadly, "I mean, I'm prepared to face this sort of thing, but I'm supposed to be safe in the trailer." Torvis told him where I was. "He's a mean, rotten son of a bitch," I said, holding Leif's pretty face in my two hands, sponging it. "We ought to kill him." And I saw the light go on in Leif's eyes. "Laurel Ann," I thought, "you would be proud of me now." Well, it's all so much like a sad old song, isn't it? The songs I sing every night, which come down to one song, which is the cheater's blues, and how much we expect from this life and how much we get. The word on us fakes and phonies is that we do a service to the true and good order of things. Torvis reminded us of that now and then, though in a leering, nasty tone of voice. Didn't matter. I believed him. The TV preachers talk about the sacred values of the family and love and marriage and the happy ending, and I believe them, too. But the devil is in whole humans like a stain that won't wash out, and we, phonies like Leif and me, are here to ensure that those bad impulses don't do permanent damage. Say a married man like that nice Mr. Courtney needs to sow some wild oats. A thing like that could ruin his entire life, set him on the road to sin black as night, unless he comes to me. I give him all he's longing for, not just the physical aspect, but the lingering looks and the heartbreak and the little goodbyes that stab and burn. And in the morning, he can go back to his wife and negotiate forgiveness from her and the Lord, and I don't suffer because I have no human soul. Leif performs much the same service for women, like presumably Mr. Courtney's wife, except that an irate husband has the option of punching him out, another service we provide. Happy to serve was the motto at the Backwater Georgia Flesh Farm where I was bred. Job satisfaction is burned into my neocortex along with the role I perform. What with all that, I guess I should have been happy, right? And was I? Oh, my Lord, no. Leif and I discussed this one Tuesday night in my trailer. Torvis had closed up and gone home, but there were crickets chirping away in the hour before dawn. We're not getting anywhere, Leif said, his eyes half open in the dark, and we're not getting younger. If we had a decent contract, we might have been able to buy ourselves out by now, buy our freedom, and maybe take a franchise on some roadhouse of our own somewhere. The standard dreams. But Torvis leeches away our salaries on his so-called expenses, and we get screwed, in any sense of the word. But Leif, if we actually, you know, I could not bring myself to say it. I've got it all figured out, Leif said. Torvis is vulnerable because of what he is. He's an old bull with no family that'll speak to him, and no friends, and no possessions but the place. And I know where he keeps his records. We kill him, and I'll doctor the books to make it look like we bought him out, and he just moved on. We get all we want all at once. His eyes were like saucers, and he hugged me. You and me together, Idella. It's forbidden for fakes to marry. Marriage is a sacred institution, and we were grown in vats like meat, not born. But if we owned the place, or appeared to, nobody would say boo if we shared a back room. And I thought again of Laurel Ann, my best friend back at the farm. She had kept me up late hours whispering all sorts of sedition, how fakes were just as good as people, and how it didn't matter how we were born, that we had the same needs and rights as whole humans, even in spite of the wet programming they read into our skulls. It wasn't fair, she said, to make us live out roles all our lives. Lonely Nels and barroom cowboys and pretty boys and all. We had our rights, and someday we would rise up and demand them. Well, this was not quite that, but it was something. Okay, I said, but I don't think I could. It's all right, my love, Leif said, still holding me. I understand. I'll do it. I'll kill him. And I thought for some reason of that old ballad they taught me back at the farm. But I've treasure of the promise that you made me in the lane when you said we'd be together when them roses bloom again. First time we tried, it was less than a week later. It was an average night. I did my two sets with the band and kept a customer happy. Guy named Idaho Charlie rode the mechanical bull for 25 minutes and would have rode longer, except his bladder ruptured. The take was good, the till was busy, and the beer was flowing like, beer. We had no specific plan, but I knew the tension had been building up at Leif. He was tight as a piano wire. He had gone so far as to snub a couple of customers, drinking by himself and looking hostile. Torvis had dressed him down for it earlier in the day, but Leif had not reformed, and now Torvis appeared long enough to hail him into his office with a rude and contemptuous gesture. Leif stood up and took a last sip of real whiskey, steeling himself, I thought, excitedly. It would not be uncommon for Torvis to hide in that office until all the whole human employees had packed up and gone home. Torvis was a secret drinker on top of everything else, so there would be no bad appearances if Leif picked this moment to put an end to our torment. I was on stage for my last set of the evening. I stumbled through the ballads and moaners dutifully, but I could not conceal my anxiety. The drummer complained that I was rushing the tempo. I apologized and jumped down, waiting for Leif to emerge. Leif did not. Time passed. A burly out-of-towner in a Teamsters uniform settled down opposite me. "You're the Nell," he said gruffly, "right?" I told him to buzz off. I purely dislike whole humans who treat me like some kind of prostitute. I am a lonely Nell. The program won't run right unless the customer is maybe a little bit in love with me. Silly one-night love, maybe. Misplaced yearning, sure. Drunken affections, but not this mean-tempered randiness. If Torvis had been around, I might have had to comply, but maybe Leif had solved that problem already. When I couldn't wait any longer, I went to the door of Torvis's back office. Maybe Leif was dead, I thought, stricken. Maybe Torvis had killed him. Maybe they had killed each other. The door was unlocked. I cracked it open and saw Torvis slumped across his desk. I slid inside. Leif was there, white as a ghost, trembling, a big kitchen knife in his hand, but the blade was clean. "He's drunk," Leif groaned. "He passed out while he was talking. Oh, Idella, I should have done it, but the programming, I just can't." I saw that he was on the brink of tears, and in spite of the disappointment, my heart went out to him. Poor Leif. That's the deepest kind of conditioning a fake person gets. The conditioning that prevents a barroom cowboy from committing violence. A cowboy is different from a Nell. Some men wouldn't tolerate his behavior even from a fake, if not for the fact that he posed no threat at all. But conditioning is not perfect. I had hoped Leif would be able to break free long enough to kill Torvis. Apparently not. I pried the knife gently out of his hand and tucked it into the deep pocket of my skirt. "Come on, baby," and I led him, still trembling, back to his trailer. Torvis had begun to snore. It cast the whole project into doubt. Laurel Ann had belabored this point often back at the flesh farm. "What we are," she said, "is what we want to be, and to hell with the roles. Wet programming impresses only a tendency on the brain," she said, "not an obligation. Most times what we are programmed to be is what we expect to be, and so we fall into the habit of complicity, but there is always a choice." So said Laurel Ann. But I thought of Leif, reduced almost to tears, with the knife in his hand, helpless. We did not speak of it, but the issue remained between us like a weight. When I could think of nothing else to do, I called up Laurel Ann's name and code from the artificials directory and got her most recent address and terminal number, a bar room in L.A. I had to steady my hand to punch out the numbers. I had not seen Laurel Ann in 20 years. We had corresponded a little, but that trailed off after a time, though we still got off Christmas cards some years. Would she even recognize me? But then her face was all over the CRT, somewhat wrinkly and careworn, but the same old Laurel Ann for all that, really still awful pretty. I smiled bravely, but when she said, "Idella," I could not hold in the tears any longer. I guess I didn't know myself just how much I had been suffering. "Honey," she said, "what's wrong with you?" So I told her the basic stuff about Torvis and how I wasn't making any money or getting any younger. There's not a whole lot of options for an aging Nell. The best I could hope for would be maybe nursemaiding a creche lot of kids out on some farm. The worst did not bear thinking about. Laurel Ann clucked appreciatively. "I know what you mean. It's not much better where I am. You just gotta face it, kiddo. The game is rigged in favor of the house. I can't help much, but if you need some cash..." "Lord, Laurel Ann, I didn't call you to cage money off you." And I thought how nice she kept her pure blonde hair, her own color. She creased her eyebrows. "What then? Not that I mind chatting. God knows it's your nickel." I told her about Leif. She sucked in her breath. Idella, that's dangerous stuff. A cowboy, wow. They're not the most reliable types in the world, you know what I mean. Oh, Leif's okay. He's loyal. You know what you told me about programming and all? No, Leif's not the program. He's not the problem. See? And I explained about our little plan. She was silent for a long time after I finished. I wondered for a sickening moment if she had changed beyond redemption, if maybe the world had broken her down. Maybe this was not the Laurel Anne I remembered from the farm. But then her consternation lifted like a cloud passing from in front of the sun, and she smiled a big, wicked smile that made her look 20 years younger. Honey, she said, my advice to you is, what the hell? Go for it. I laughed and she laughed. Leif's a problem, though, I said. His cowboy conditioning. He can't bring himself to hurt the old son of a bitch. There's two solutions I can think of, Laurel Anne said. Yeah? Well, first off, keep in mind, you're not a cowboy. I saw what she meant. Oh, but no, I couldn't. I have my own conditioning, you know. She waved it away. There's another possibility. I guess this Leif of yours isn't up to direct violence, but maybe you can make some arrangement, you understand? See that old Toby has an accident. That way, Leif doesn't have to be there when it happens. I sighed happily. Laurel Anne, you are a genius. She grinned again, just happy to get in on the action. We chatted a while, then Laurel Anne said, okay, gotta go. And she added something wicked and obscene. Invite me to the wedding, she said. Leif and I sat up late making plans. Very bright girl, this Laurel Anne, he said. Oh, Leif, do you suppose it'll really work? I don't see why not. And we'll have the place? Sure thing. You and me together? For eternity, he said, and kissed me so sweetly I could have cried. We used a length of steel wire Leif extracted from an old hollow set in the junk pile Torvis kept behind the place. He greased it so it wouldn't shine in the dark. Torvis had beer delivered in big steel kegs once a week. He stored them in the cold room down under the place, a nasty timber and concrete basement with the floorboards of the bar room creaking and swaying above it. Here was the crux of the plan. Every Friday night, providing he was sober enough to do so, Torvis would go down into that hole to count the kegs. Consumption's up, he would say, grousing because he'd have to put in a bigger order, or consumption's down, grousing 'cause business was off. Friday, before he arrived, we snuck in through his office and down a ways into that lightless place where the beer was kept. The stairway was rickety and narrow and smelled of old malt. First, Leif unscrewed the light bulb at the bottom so it would look to have burned out. Then he came back up to the second stair or so. He had bought some of those steel eye-hole screws from the hardware store up in Lawson. He drove one into the supports at each side of the star. Then he threaded the steel wire between them, tying it off as tight as he could. Then he twisted the screw eyes a couple of more times until the wire hummed like the high E string on an electric guitar. He gave it a final slick of shoe polish, and we backed to the top of the stairway. The wire was invisible. Leif was shaking. I held his hand. This is it, girl, he whispered. This is our ticket. Keep your fingers crossed. It was a nervous night, you might imagine. I felt elated, optimistic, sick, all at once. I suppose I was feeling some of what Leif must have felt when he hovered over the body of Torvis with that big meat knife in his hand back at the farm There was a motto we heard almost as often as Happy to Turr, which was, "You can't cheat fate." Maybe that is so, I thought, but you can, by God, try. I sang up there on the stage with the band behind me, the same old songs that are precisely the story of my life, loved and lost and the guy who left me behind, but I sang them. I would pledge with a special poignancy that night, "Let me be in your arms tonight," I sang, and Leif smiled his big white smile all alone at his table. "I shouldn't, but I love you. This is sin, but it feels so good." Oh, yes. Torvis did not appear in public that night. We had been for a couple of weeks circulating rumors among the staff that he was planning to sell out. I suppose those rumors accelerated during the evening. Any ordinary evening, Torvis usually appeared at least once to guarantee that the bar was churlishly tended or to badger the waitresses and put his fat hands on their behinds. But he did not. Time passed, and after a while everybody went home, and it was not long before dawn, and still Torvis had not appeared. The entrance to the cellar is strictly through Torvis's private office. I looked at Leif. Leif looked at me. "He could be drunk," Leif whispered. "We have to know," I said. "We have to at least know." So we tiptoed through the dark and silent, sawdust-scattered barroom to Torvis's door, which was not locked. It was dark inside. I found the light switch. Torvis was sitting there, grinning like a maniac, the tripwire dangling in his hand. "Well, by God, it would be you two," he waved us in, almost a friendly gesture. "There's nowhere to run to, so you might as well sit and chat for a time." Leif entered the room stiff-legged, eyes wild as if his brain weren't firing on all cylinders, and me behind, hot in the face, angry and scared, both at once. Torvis perched on the edge of his desk, one hand curled around a bottle of Southern Comfort. There was a bruise on his cheek and some blood around one ankle, so I guessed the tripwire had worked, just not well enough. He had fallen down the stairs, but it hadn't killed him, and now he knew. "Well, well, well, I guess I should have expected this. You buy cheap fakes, you get what you pay for." He laced his link sausage fingers across the belly of his yoke shirt. His string tie was askew. "I should have known." "We didn't," Leif stammered hopelessly. You don't think..." And I fingered the knife I had been carrying in my dress pockets since I prized it out of Leif's hand that day. "Don't make it worse," Torvis said, turning grim for the first time. "Wouldn't have worked anyhow. I guess you thought you could take over the place, kill me and take over the place and live like as if you were real people. Ha! Oh, you could have killed me, I guess, if this chicken shit plan had worked out. Killed me without facing me, 'cause you can't do that. Just some underhanded trick. But even if it worked, where are you?" His hand lingered about the telephone terminal. I guessed he was going to call the local artificials board and we would be processed dog food, me and Leif both, before the next nightfall. "Because you're not human," Torvis said gleefully. He grinned, his face like a big pumpkin. "That's the flaw. It all comes out in the programming, don't it? You can't dodge a program. You can't cheat fate." I guess it was the words that set me off, made me think of the farm and of poor Leif's programmed helplessness. Torvis had already started punching out numbers on the terminal, chuckling crazily to himself, when the knife came down again and again in my hand. We hid him in that cold, dark basement back of the beer kegs. "Got a surprise for you," Leif said one night after the ruckus had died down and we were alone in the place again. Our place, as I had lately begun to think of it. "Surprise?" I asked. and he opened up the front doors in a grand gesture, and Laurel Ann waltzed in. Comes to the same thing, seems to me. We play our roles, and we want what we're so often promised, our one true lover, our happy ending. I thought all of this while I cried into Laurel Ann's pretty blonde hair. Leif said she needed a job. We need a new Nell, and we can pay her double salary until she buys herself free. I looked at her. She nodded, grinning. Of course, she said, that's not the main reason I'm here. The main reason? Didn't want to miss your wedding. I wept all over again. Laurel Ann sang When Those Roses Bloom Again alone up on stage in the empty barroom, and Leif and I said the vows about forsaking all others and death do us part and so forth, and he put a crackerjack ring on my finger, and he was my cowboy bridegroom and I was his jukebox bride. Well, business picked up after that. Torvis was unmissed and unmourned. Leif took over accounting. Laurel Ann stood it as Nell, though I continued to sing the songs every night. The sad old songs, the ballads in waltz time, sad and true. Fate is a tricky and mean opponent, they seem to say. He sneaks up from behind. I stood up on stage and watched them glide across the dance floor. My old friend and my true love. His hand was on the shoulder of her taffeta gown. His other hand pressed her tight, and his eyes, those gorgeous cowboy eyes, were all lit up with love, while the band played in three-quarter time. We continue with a story from the March 1987 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Faust Forward by Mark Laidlaw. Old Rotcod's cottage rose like a tombstone on the edge of the merry meadow, casting its gloomy image over the otherwise cheerful face of Glamourspell Pond. When the fairy kids came down to frolic in the mud, they always kept to the stretch of shoreline farthest from the sagging gray house. Not that they would ever say a word against it. When they saw old Rotcod himself scowling out through a dust-bleared window, they would wave and call for him to strip from his strict black garments and come join them for a naked swim in the crystalline pond. No one was offended when he ignored them or made a face and pulled the blinds. Only the most radical fairies hinted that it was just as well he kept to himself, that his presence might dim the blue water like a bottle of black ink spilled into a sacred well. And not a fairy kid took offense when, coming down to the pond on a hot day with their picnic baskets and water nymphs, they discovered that in the night the bond had been surrounded by a barrier of fairy-proof iron thorn shrubberies. Instead, they shrugged and giggled at Rotcod's humor, then wandered away in search of another spot in which to pass the afternoon. In the dim recesses of his cottage, Rotcod waited until the sounds of merriment had expired in the depths of the forest. It was too much to hope that they had been devoured by carnivores or snatched by starving fairy traps, though the thoughts made him chuckle. Maybe now I can get some work done. His ponderous desk was covered with immense volumes whose pages he had stained with his lunches or crumpled in his frustration. He opened one at random, a bright blue tome whose milk-white pages were covered with glittering golden calligraphy that began to incant in angelic tones as his eyes fell upon the first paragraph. By the power of Nazical, the arch-image may easily acquaint himself with all the heavenly vaultings up to and including the 16th, which surpasses the common intelligences of invisibility, omniscience, clairvoyance, clairaudience, teleofaction, levitation, immortal. Oh, shut up. He slammed the book silent in mid-syllable. Rising from his hard, creaking chair, he began to shove the books to the floor. Many cried out at his handling, and one in particular, a text of practical magical philosophy which had often warned him against studying forbidden things, began to weep like a sentimental idiot. "Oh, Rotcod," it wailed from the floor. "Rotcod, turn back before it is too late. Correct your behavior, I beg you. Bend diligently to your astrology. Take up your thaumaturge's tools. Call upon the elements and..." Rotcod stepped squarely on one flickering page of admonitions, then stooped and tore the book in half along the spine. There was a chorus of screams from the other books as he tossed the volume into the squat black furnace he had forged himself from unholy iron, having found no fairy smith able to do the work without contracting a devilish dermatitis. "What good is magic?" he demanded of the leaping flames. He swept his stern gaze over the rest of his library, but the surviving books lay timid and sullen now, infected with his ill humor. "I have practiced demonology for 1,300 years, with nothing to show for it but a horde of mindless slaves who are powerless to think for themselves. I've sucked the juice from all forms and colors of magic, black, white, purple, and plaid. I have a phoenix that craps molten gold in my hands. Immortality, invisibility, lead into gold, into lead again, and it's all worthless. These are things any man can accomplish." "Any man? Ha! Any fairy! Even the lazy fairies live forever." He began to stalk around the room, kicking through books, searching for one in particular. "I know you're here. You've kept silent all these years because of that damned philosophy. It's gone now, do you hear? It can't bully you anymore. Speak up. You whispered to me once, I remember. You said there was something more than magic. I was half asleep with boredom from that astral sex manual, but I came wide awake and you fell silent." There was a muted gobble, but the other books hurried to quash it, spreading their leaves over the spot. Rotcod dug into the heap of gilt buckram and dragon scale, at last emerging with a slim back volume nipped in his nails. "Don't say a word," cried Three Sequelae to the book he had burned. But the black book, squirming in his hand, dryly rustling, fluttering its pages like a bird about to take wing, dust drifted over his sleeve. "At last," it whispered, opening flat on his palm. "Yes," said Rotcod, "you are the one, aren't you?" "No, Rotcod, no," cried the others. "Be silent or I'll use you all to warm the cottage." The black volume settled down into the wrinkles of his palm, emanating a darkly prosaic light as it found its voice for the first time in years. He could no longer remember how he had acquired the book. Eons ago, perhaps, he had picked it up from the estate of a wizard moving on to a higher plane. In his youth, it would have meant little to him, for in those days, all magic had lain before him, unfathomed, unfulfilled. That was before he had tired of the world and its limitlessness. He had gorged himself on the fattest books, while this one resembled nothing so much as a pamphlet bound in human skin. "What are you?" he asked. "I am science," said the book. The room seemed to recede. The anxious voices of his familiar volumes were muffled by the thunder of blood in his ears. "Science?" he repeated. "Yes, I've heard of you now and then, but my magical friends have kept you well hid, haven't they?" "For your own good," cried a flapping ephemeris. "I've had enough of your judgments," he told his library. "I'll come to my own opinions from now on." "Excellent," said the slender book. "Let me show you my world." His eyes darkened. "Not another dimension, I hope. Not another fantastic door into dreams. I've had enough of worlds within worlds. I'm warning you. No, nothing like that. It is the world, but transmuted, purged of magic. Imagine the sameness of day after day. Imagine that the living will die and stay dead. Stay dead? Impossible. Let me show you, Ratkad. Let us take a walk. No, Ratkad, no, cried his old books, but he scarcely heard them now. He twisted the mummified fist of a doorknob and let himself out, flinching instinctively from the golden sunlight that always awaited him, unless the air was full of moonlight or starshine. But today, strangely, the light seemed thin and insubstantial. It hardly warmed his black-clad arms. Too late! Too late! Wailed the volumes in his house. The door just managed to slam itself shut. A feverish breeze blew through the iron hedge. Ratkad tucked the black book under his arm, where he could listen to its dry ruminations as he walked. The grass, he noticed, no longer looked as relentlessly green as was common, and here and there he noted scraps and twisted bits of metal among the mild flowers. You sense my power already, said the book approvingly. I can see that you will be an excellent student. What is this I see around me? These stray fragments of, I know not the word, trash. Ratkad shivered at the wrongness of the sound, so lacking in the mellifluous quality he had come to associate with everything in his world. Normally, his ears would have picked up the laughter of fairies at a great distance. They were always troubling his concentration, but today he could hardly hear them. Accordingly, they found him first, surprising him before he had reached their favorite glade. With a cascade of laughter, they sprang into being from trees and boulders, forming a ring around him. He had the impression that they were transparent, that the forest itself was a crude painting done on glass with watery figments. Only the book seemed real. Hello, Ratkad, the nearest fairy girl said. She was tiny and blonde, with flowers decked in her hair, and she seemed intent on hugging him around the knees. You've come to play with us, haven't you? The book chuckled. Go ahead. Ratkad stooped and brushed his fingers through the child's hair, scattering petals that fell like drops of lead and singed the grass. She screamed and backed away from him, her voice hardly reaching his ears. He wasn't sure if he was delighted or in agony with fairies. It was hard to tell. She went kicking away from him, gray in the face, stumbling over roots and rocks, and finally she sprawled backwards, there to lie unmoving while her face grew blacker and blacker. Suddenly, the forest looked real again, more solid than ever. The voices of the other fairies sounded sharp as they gathered around their companion. What are you doing, Kalesa? You're not breathing. I don't believe it, said Ratkad. She's dead. They looked at him in astonishment. Dead? Said one. It was a word they knew from myths. None of them seemed to remember quite what it meant. To Ratkad, it had suddenly ceased being an abstraction. He noticed that around the little blonde corpse were stray bits of string, wads of paper towel, more trash. He turned on his heel and strode off towards the house, holding the book open with both hands, conversing loudly as he went. I thought it was a fable, he explained, but now I have seen it with my own eyes. Death! Imagine! Then what of the other things I've thought incredible? They can all be yours. What of disease? Is there truly such a thing? There can be, yes. A bird toppled from its perch in a branch overhead. Its eyes were drops of blood. He paused to watch as worms humped from the ground and began to devour it, but they too broke out in blood and began to fester where they crawled. Incredible, he said, and it will spread. He hurried on, spying his cottage. The iron hedge around the pond had begun to rust. The thorns looked poisonous to man and fairy alike. His house had also changed. The roof sat squarely atop the walls. The place no longer sagged or glowered, but simply inhabited space like any little box. He was surprised to see an identical dwelling in the middle of the Merry Meadow, and another beyond that. A great deal of building was underway. Huge vehicles lumbered about, scraping the uneven earth into uniformity. They moved with none of the grace of the ferry's floating boats, and they spouted dense black smoke. Two monsters collided, and the drivers sprang out, cursing so vehemently that Rotcod expected the ground to open beneath them. Instead, they drew expandable tubes, aimed them at one another, and each dropped dead to the grass. He studied their deaths for some time, wondering how quickly this new twist would lose its novelty. In a thoughtful mood, Rotcod entered his house and found it much changed in his absence. There were no dark corners, no books to berate him or offer opinions for his consideration. He set the black pamphlet on a polished counter and moved through the rooms, shading his eyes from the glaring light that emanated from the ceilings. He felt lost, uncertain of which furniture was meant for sitting or sleeping on. He returned at last to the black book. "What is all this?" he asked. The book did not reply. He thought it might be formulating an explanation, but gradually he realized that it was simply inert. Its characters did not glow or try to catch his eyes. When it remained mute, he attempted to read it. Every page was covered with instructions, printed in numerical order, but meaningless despite the arrangement. "What is a capacitor?" he asked. "What is slot A?" The volume defied both his eye and his intellect until he closed it and set it down carefully. He was afraid to hurl it against the wall, as he had so many other books. This one, in its quiet way, commanded his respect. Rotcod cast an eye heavenward and saw that gray vapor cloaked the sky beyond the tinted windows. Stepping outside, he found that it burned his lungs as well. The forest had been neatly cleared while he was indoors, and among the stumps, the fairy kids sat with forlorn expressions. When they saw him, they visibly brightened, recognizing their companion from the old world. They started towards him, and Rotcod could not keep himself from hurrying to meet them halfway. He had never thought he would welcome their company, but the sound of their laughter warmed him in an unfamiliar way. He hurried along the thorny barrier he had erected last night with a few choice syllables, thankful that the fairies had not changed. It was their way to face difficulties with grace and equanimity. Unfortunately, he stumbled in a pothole and rolled to the brown grass a moment before they reached him. He was thus unprepared when, still smiling, they drew their steel knives and fell upon him. We return to the April 1987 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction for our final story, Letters to Mother by Chet Williamson. 1. Dear Mother, I suppose that writing a letter to you now is foolish. Most people would say that you're gone, beyond hearing. Father would, but you're too real to me, too alive and vital for me to ever think of you as completely gone. My memories of you have been so rich and vivid, of walking in the garden with you, of how you used to fuss so over my dresses, of how understanding you were, both you and Father, when my marriage broke up. Those memories won't die, Mother. I wish you could have seen Father at the funeral. He was so sad. He feels very guilty, I believe. If you'd have known how truly bad he feels, you never would have done what you did. It wasn't right, Mother. I wish you hadn't done it, and I wish Father feels the same way. He hasn't seen Kathy since. I don't think he will anymore, but I'll take very good care of him. In spite of what he did, I still love him. I love you too, Mother. Somehow, somewhere, you'll read this and you'll know. I'll put it in the little carved wooden box you brought me from Mexico. It will stay there just as you stay in my thoughts. I think of you constantly, your loving daughter. 2. Dear Mother, I should have known it would be too good to last. He's marrying her, Mother, marrying Kathy. I thought that a year, and has it been a whole year since you left us, would make him forget her. But it was you he wanted to forget, Mother. They had been seeing each other behind my back the whole time, and I felt like such a fool when I found out. I asked him why, and he told me that he needed someone to love him, and when I said I loved him, he laughed at me and kissed me and said that what he needed was more than I could give. I got angry then, Mother, and asked how he could be sure that she loved him. She was so young, and how did he know she wasn't just interested in his money? That made him mad then, and he told me he knew she loved him because she had agreed to the procedure when it was time. You wouldn't know about the procedure, Mother. The Burdick procedure is its full name. After the man who developed it, I don't understand the details, but if one person is dying, another healthy person can be linked to him somehow, so that the healthy body acts to keep the dying one alive. It's very new, but they think that both people can be kept alive far beyond their normal lifespans. Some of the people who helped in the first experiment said that they could actually share the thoughts of the other person, but they didn't go all the way because once the link is made, there's no going back. The pair can no longer live apart, and neither one can do anything, not even watch the video. So it's a true sacrifice on the healthy one's part, though it's a beautiful thing to think of a husband and wife sharing their thoughts and memories for who knows how long, maybe forever. If only you and Father could have done that, it would have been like making your love immortal. But he and Kathy filled out the papers, and he told me that she was loving him, and that's how he knew. So I went to see her, Mother. It was the first time I ever met her face to face, and I was so surprised. I knew she was young, but she doesn't look any older than I, Mother. I asked her if she really loved him, and of course she told me she did. And when I asked her if she loved his money, too, she just said that certainly that was part of it, that Father wouldn't be the man he was without his money. Then I said that since Father was so much older than she, it was likely that he would go first, and was she really ready to go through with the procedure? Oh, Mother, she smiled just like a crocodile, and I knew she was lying, but she only said of course she would, that it would be a pleasure to spend all those years sharing the thoughts of a man like Father. I couldn't talk to her anymore after that. To love someone as much as I love Father, and to see him throw his life away, and yours too, Mother, over a whore like that, is more than I can bear. I will not go to the wedding. Mother, you can rest secure in that knowledge. I think of you constantly, your loving daughter. 3. Dear Mother, I knew it all along. 3 years, such a little time for love to fade, and such a great love as Kathy claimed she had. He's dying of cancer, Mother, as I'm sure she feared most. I'm sure she wished that he would have had a stroke or died in an accident or gotten ill and quickly faded somewhere on one of his visits to the other side of the world, so she couldn't have gotten there in time. But she played the odds and lost. There is plenty of time for the procedure. I saw him today. He looked so frail that it would break your heart, and all he could say was, thank God. Thank God for Kathy and the procedure. And she sat there in the corner, pale as death, tears in her eyes and her lips clamped shut, not saying a word. I looked at her while he was clenching my hand with all his strength, as if I could keep him from slipping away before it was time, before tomorrow's procedure was done. I looked at her, Mother, and I saw so much fear that she made Father look brave in comparison. She got up and left the room, and Father said to me, she's a good woman. She's so good to me. Just nervous is all, just nervous. I followed her and talked to her in the lounge. I won't, she said. I won't do it. No one can make me. She was actually crying, Mother. I didn't know that she could cry. You signed the papers, I told her. When you married him, you agreed to. But she said she wouldn't, that it was stupid, like burying wives with dead kings, and that there was nothing in the papers that said she had to. I asked to see them then, and she had them right in her purse. Oh, she was so clever, so ready for anything, but she was right. I read all through them, and there was no way to force her to do it. Then I said, if you're not going to do it, why are you crying? She looked at me as if I were some kind of monster and told me that she loved him. But suddenly, I realized the truth. You won't get any money, I said. If you don't do it, you won't get a cent. And I could see from her face that I was right. But she said she didn't care, that she'd rather be alive and poor. I went back to Father's room then and asked him if he really wanted to undergo the procedure instead of drifting off into a quiet sleep, and he told me yes, that he did not want to die. I asked him, Mother, what there was about death that terrified him so. Was he afraid that there wouldn't be an afterlife? And he cried, and he told me he was afraid there would be, and that he would see you there, Mother, and he couldn't bear that. Oh, Mother, it's not because he doesn't love you, it's because he does. And I cried too, and held him, loving him so much, and wanting him to be happy, and loving you too, Mother. And then I came home, trying to think of what I could do for Father. Please help me find the answer, Mother. I will listen for your voice. I think of you constantly, your loving daughter. 4. Dear Mother, Father and I are together now. It was so simple. I called Kathy that night and we worked it out. The next morning, this past morning, a year ago, time means so little now, I signed all my property over to her. So now she has what she wanted, and she gave me the papers, and now I have what I suppose I always wanted. Father and I are as close as we can be. Kathy's and my age were nearly the same. Height and weight were similar, and our blood types were identical. That was the key to it all. And why would hospital personnel check? Why would they think anyone else would offer herself as a substitute? And even if they find out the truth, it's too late now to change it. Oh, Mother, Father was so surprised to find himself with me. It was just in time, too. He had slipped into a coma in the morning, but I brought him back to life. I did it. I explained to him, thought to him, as my thoughts reach out to you now, what was happening. And he was angry. He actually believed that Kathy had wanted to and that I had stopped her, though I told him the whole truth. Still, he was angry. And then I learned that I was stronger than he was, my thoughts, Mother, and that I could calm him, although he can still be angry or sad in a very small part of himself, a hidden part that we don't share, not yet. It's so good now that we're all together again. You are with us, Mother, just as you have always been with me. Sometimes Father is bad and wants to think about Kathy, but I won't let him. We don't think about her at all anymore. We think about you, Mother. We think of you constantly, your loving daughter, your faithful husband. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.